Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the leader in waterfowl conservation, with over 16 million acres of habitat conserved. DU supporters and volunteers have led the charge to fill the skies with waterfowl, today, tomorrow, and forever. You too can play a role in leaving a legacy for the future of waterfowl hunting. To find an event near you or to join our volunteer team, go to www.ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Hey guys, it's Brent Birch back again with another episode of The Standard Sportsman. I'm joined by my co-host, Kaysen Short. We're coming out of the spring, even though I can't decide what it wants to be. It was 30-something degrees here. I guess night before last or whatever it was. But anyway, cool snap. It's a little cold this morning. I walked my dog and I didn't dress right. I was a little chilly. But Kaysen, what you got going on?
Man, I'm trying to survey a little bit of wind or storm damage from that 50-mile-an-hour sustained wind we had yesterday. It was brutal out here in the wide open, just absolutely aggravating. But, man, we're busy planting rice. Shut down right now because it rained last night, but we got a bunch of acreage in the ground and, you know, farming, draining water, holding ducks. Just March, good old-fashioned March.
The Standard Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Waterfowl hunters deserve to have a set of waders that can excel year in and year out throughout the duration of the season. So Sitka Gear set out to build the best pair of waders ever. Constructed from Gore-Tex Pro Laminate, the face fabric offers added durability and is breathable in active working conditions while completely sealing out the elements. Importantly, they proudly stand behind all of their Delta Zip wader features with their 100% serviceable guarantee. And I'm speaking from experience as I have sent my original pair of Sitka waders from the 2018 season back twice without a hiccup. Engineered to outwork, outlast, and outhunt everything else in the market, the Delta Zip Wader from Sitka Gear is the gold standard for reliability. The Chatham Jacket from Tom Beckby features a durable, weatherproof 8-ounce wax shelter cloth shell that develops a great-looking patina with use. I've actually worn this jacket the last couple of seasons and appreciate the shorter cut to it, so it fits great inside my waders. It's also a really good weight for most Arkansas days of field. So if you'd like to mix a little vintage look with your technical gear waders, this is the jacket. You can find the jacket online at tombeckby.com. You can also find it in their brick and mortar locations in Wilson, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, and the new store in Oxford, Mississippi. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I went to the farm last weekend and did some spring cleaning things and met a dirt work guy to move some pits around. Now that we've owned this place 3 years, I've got some different ideas and observe, you know, based on observations where it's mostly speckle belly related, just places they use versus where I thought they might use. So I met him on Saturday and monkeyed around down there, but we hadn't done a thing farming wise. We farm really late, intentionally, obviously. It's a farm dedicated to ducks. So we're not in any big hurry. I mean, we cut rice like the old days. We cut it in October. And we've even cut it before in early November. So, we hadn't turned any dirt, not a bit.
That's good stuff when you can do it like that. And this little conversation will segue into our guest here in just a second. But we're kind of on the opposite side of it with production, farming for production. We're trying to really to get so far out in front with modern ag production that we can grow some rice on the back end for waterfowl. And this the field that we intend to ratoon crop went in yesterday. So hopefully we'll see, we may try some other, if we cut some other stuff early on and try it too, but trying to kind of do the opposite, swing the pendulum so far the other direction that we can increase these duck energy days. But that brings up our guest that we've got coming on today, does a lot in the same area, not just in timber management, but they've got some ag fields that they work with. And I'm curious to see what their strategy is, because there's kind of two ways to do it. I definitely admire that you guys have the ability to do it on the back end and can tolerate planting and growing late, because Lord knows when you put waste grain on the ground in late October, it's a lot more likely it'll be here in duck season than if you put it on the ground in August. So, but without further ado, I want to welcome Max Sharp to the show, owner of Straight Lake or founder of Straight Lake. Max, welcome to the podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. What's going on in your world?
Well, we've been draining water and fighting beavers, and you know, we left some water on late to imprint some ducks, and did our banding program with Dr. Doug Osborne in February. Had a great banding year, and we're just getting ready to farm. We hadn't planted anything, but we've got some fields. We've got a few fields disc. We're fighting the rain. Seems like every time it gets dry enough to kind of get started, you know, then we have another 2 inch rain. So we're subject to biodevue at Straight Lake. So we're a little careful. We don't want to be harvesting late, but we always have a trouble getting planted early too, you know. So
sure. Yeah, it seems to be the case with us. You know, you look around now at the number of acres that farmers farm, you know, as individual farmers, and then you look at the equipment, modern equipment, you wonder why so much equipment, why such big equipment. But it seems like in the last couple of decades, we just farm in between these windows of opportunity. We get a short period, we get to work, and man, you better get after it because it's going to rain. And even though we've had a wet spring, we've done pretty well up here. We've got a lot more acres planted right now than we did this time last year. Of course, last year it stayed wet for a while, and then we got, I think, all of our rice and almost all of our beans in without stopping, which is very abnormal. But
yeah, last year was a really good farm year, and I always tell my guys they'll get a little disgruntled, you know, AJ and Jacob, and I'm like, look, good Lord's always going to give you an opportunity. You just have to seize it when it becomes available. And ours is always a little bit later just because of the bio getting down and stuff. But like I said, we've got some stuff worked up and slicked off. So and if you can get it to that point, it makes it fast. You can run the DMI over it, and we airflow everything that we plant at Straight Lake. So then you just have to run the hair over it and you're done, you know, and we can wait 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, you know, to put our levees in and stuff like that until we get ready to start watering. We've got some pretty flat fields in some places, but most of it is kind of opti level, still has snake levees in it. And I like that. I like to have a little diversity in my water, you know, where some of the water's a little deeper and some of the water's skinny. I think the ducks prefer that over a whole bunch of precision level stuff. It's a lot more. Sure. It's a lot more work to put those fields in and plant those levees and all that. But I do think it adds something to the farm. You know, I think the snake levees. I don't know. It's kind of old school. You know, and I'm an old school guy. So
yeah, well, we still use them too.
Oh yeah, well, I was gonna say easy on the old school stuff because we don't have any zero grade, and I don't want it. I'm not a fan of zero grade. I know that was a big trend for a while, but I'm 100% with you. Even this morning, looking at where we're holding water still, we've got 200 or 300 acres of water still, and the ducks are up there in the skinny water today. You know, they like, some days they want deep, big open water. Some days they want to be where they can put their feet down. So if you're designing a property, if you really have that in mind, I think the diversity, like you talked about, is crucial. And not just in ag production, the same with woods and everything else. They don't like the same thing every day, all the time.
No, same thing, to your point. In the woods, you know, sometimes they're, you know, late season, they want to hit that skinny water. Early season, they don't care. They're everywhere. But, yeah, I mean, they very much, if you watch ducks, if you really pay attention to what they're doing, they like diversity.
Let's back up a little bit because we can go down this path really well, but let's talk about what prompted you to get into this, to start Straight Lake and to get started this direction.
Well, what started it was passion. I've been a passionate waterfowler for, I'm 54 years old, for 35 years, super passionate. I live in the northwest corner of Louisiana. I hosted a TV show for about 8 years called Old School Outdoors. I was looking for land in southeast Arkansas. I'm shortening this story up because it's got a lot of twists and turns to it, but I was looking in southeast Arkansas for a piece of flooded timber or something with some hags and flooded timber to build, you know, the ultimate waterfowl compound. And I was part of Green Tree. It's down around Winchester, Arkansas, McGehee area, Lake Village area. And the guy that sold the land to Green Tree, I called him and he said, Max, there's nothing in Southeast Arkansas that's going to satisfy your waterfowl desires. And I was like, okay, well, he said, you need to go to Northeast Arkansas. So in 2013, he knew of one piece of property in Northeast Arkansas that might be for sale. And I went up and looked at it. And when we drove in the gate, I knew that it was the place. It had agriculture. It had a natural swag being the old lake bed. You know, those things historically, you know, waterfowl areas. And had some had a block of woods, and on the north end of the property, it was only a 300 acre tract, but it was long. It was 40 acres wide in some places and 80 acres wide in others, and it was about a mile, almost a mile long, for 300 acres, and on the north end of it was a dead end, and a place that had been kind of mismanaged, and it was grown up in rozos and just terrible vegetation and stuff, and. The guy that I bought it from, he was a huge Alabama fan, lived across the street from Bryant-Denny Stadium. And we were leaving the property after we looked at it. I said, let me out. I had a pair of knee boots on. I tromped across this old muddy field, you know, and I got back to the truck and he just had this quizzical look on his face. Like I was absolutely crazy. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, that's where I'm gonna build my lodge. And he goes, oh, no, son, you'll never move enough dirt to build a lodge there. And I said, well, Mr. Steve, I've been moving dirt all my life, you know. I said, I can move the dirt. So, and that is where the lodge is located now. And currently we're even clearing a little more ground and we're going to put some owner suites in for our members. But we ended up buying that piece and just kind of watching what was going on the property next to us. And when BioDeview would get out, you know, it would just be a mecca, you know, and I just had this vision, you know, about if you could impound that and keep the bio out of it and then, you know, use your levees as twofold to hold your duck water and keep the bio out of your crops, you know, how special that would be. And then and it was just a series of years and relationships and, and so the big block of woods that we have, it's a 320 acre block. That's, it's actually a section of ground. It's half ag and half. We started hunting it just out of an ask, you know, we asked the landowner and we were very respectful with him. He said, they always hunted just in what we call our hornet hole or the big hole. And they had a big blind in it. They would come into that blind from the east. They had a road built into the woods. And he said, look, you can hunt in these woods anytime you want to, you know, but just hunt on the west side. And the west side kind of bordered up our, against our dead end. And I said, no, I said, I'm not going to do that. If y'all are hunting, I said, I know how that would be, you know, if we were shooting and disturbing y'all. And I said, I'll just stay in touch with you. And, you know, I appreciate you allowing us to hunt, and but I want to be ultimately respectful. And I said, you just let me know when y'all are not going to hunt. And that went on for a couple of years. And we hunted in there, you know, probably 8 or 10 times a year with permission when they weren't hunting and had some fabulous hunts. He called me up, you know, a few years into that arrangement, he called me up and he said, hey, we're done hunting. We're going to let y'all, if you want to lease it, we're going to let you lease it. So I said, you know, absolutely. So we started leasing that property. And then a couple of years later, he called and he said, hey, we're going to sell it. And I was like, wow, you know, just getting an opportunity to buy something in flooded woods, you know, was pretty special. So we bought that piece of property and then, you know, rocked on a few years and had an opportunity to buy some property from some people that are very large landowners in Woodruff County that don't typically sell land. You know, it's usually out of the question to buy land. And we bought about 1,300 acres of Bayou frontage from them. And so it's happened in 8 or 10 real estate deals. We also developed a 160-acre tract that's about 2 miles west of the lodge. That's not it's not adjacent to us. It's separated, but it's more in the Cache River flyway, and we've owned it for now 5 years, and we've never hunted it. We've imprinted it. We put water on it every year, and we're just, you know, we're kind of building it. It had no levees, no wells, you know, created a GTR over there. And we're pretty excited about it. It's coming on really strong. Lots of ducks in it from the middle of the season. And now we've developed a relationship over there to have a rest area. And that I've always, when it got a bunch of ducks in it, I was always scared to go shoot it because I was like, those ducks don't have a place to go. You know, and they're going to leave the property if you go shoot them. So we've never shot it. We made some great videos over there and enjoyed it, but we have never shot it. So then we bought some property on the south end of the south side of the bayou on Bayou de Vue. So most of the stuff that we own is on the north and south side of Bayou de Vue for about 3.5 miles, which is pretty special because if you start reading the old books and stuff like that, Bayou de Vue is in every single one of them, you know, along with the Cache River and the White River in our general geographic area. So it's just a special place. We've had an incredible team working on development that really bought into the vision of what I wanted it to look like and how I wanted to set it up. And now, our duck projects has made our farming a little tougher because we've impounded, you know, large fields that were 150 acres and broke them up into 30 and 40 acre tracts. So it's made our farming a little tougher, but we're like Brent said, we're into the production and we want to make a crop to help offset our cost, but we're not a total duck food farm. But we're absolutely ducks first and farming second.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the way we, you know, people hear, you know, individuals talk about farming for ducks. They think, okay, you're farming and you're leaving everything you farm, you leave it behind. And you're the same. I mean, you're taking, you're harvesting, you know, we leave a food plot here and there, and more of it. We've got some corn we leave it. And it's more not necessarily for the food, it's for the overhead cover.
Yeah, thermal.
They like to get up in. Because, you know, they'll wipe the food part out pretty quick. And but they do like that cover, and it kind of guarantees you're going to have that. At least on our farm it is. It's kind of an insurance plan to make sure they're going to have something they can get in. But so how many acres are you talking about, you know, now that you've accumulated all these different parcels? And then how much is ag and how much is GTR?
Okay. Now there's one more part of that caveat that I didn't finish. We had a, when we formed a membership at Stray Lake and took on members, I was so in debt. I mean, I was stretched to the hilt, and I've been blessed with finances. I can't deny, but I was so in debt, 13, 15 million upside down in all this. And I was day hunting it. And the day hunting every year would produce exactly enough to pay the interest. And it was driving me crazy because I couldn't figure out, you know, long-term how I was going to get out of this debt. And so I had been a part of other equity clubs, you know, at Davis Island. It's a deer place. And I have a couple memberships down there that my boys really enjoy, but it's probably been 5 or 6 years since I've even been there for any length of time. And I said, you know, the main thing, I just evaluated my goals of what I wanted out of this property. And what I wanted to do was be able to control the pressure and get out of debt, you know, and have a fabulous duck place. So I kind of modeled it after a club that was in South Louisiana called the Coastal Club. And I was familiar with it, and I've been down there hunting a lot. And their memberships come with a certain number of days, you know, that the member can use the property. And they draw for those days. So that's what we do at Straight Lake. It's been fabulous. If our members don't get what they want in the draw, you know, the specific dates that they want, then usually there's a lot of trading that goes on after the fact. And at the end of the day, everybody ends up happy. So, we have got a tremendous group of members. I was very careful in selecting those members, making sure that they had good conservation values and family values. And you know, it's just been incredible. I mean, it's just been a phenomenal project. I feel super blessed to be the founder, and it's really my God-sized dream. You know, somebody asked me one time, they're like, why do you do this? And I was like, it's just my dream. You know, I mean, it's the biggest dream that you could have in life, you know. This is it for me, you know, and everybody's got a different dream, but that was my dream, you know, to have a duck property that you could manage and not lose to, you know, leasing ground. We did that for years, and you'd always lose a lease to the son-in-law or brother-in-law, or, you know, as soon as you figured out how to hunt a farm, you were fixing to get run off.
Yep. Seen that plenty.
Yeah. So owning ground is special. You know, it's your mentality about it is different. Everything about it is just different because you own it, and being a good steward of the land and building the ground up, and, you know, having your water control structures right, being able to get the water on, get it off, you know. And Straight Lake's a very complicated property for that. I will say that it's not easy, you know. And our farm ground, you know, at Straight Lake, I would say is what you would call marginal farm ground. It's not this high ice cream ground. You know, it's tough to farm. It would be tough for a commercial farmer to farm it. And that's why we do it all ourselves at Straight Lake. You know, we have a farmer that works for the club, and the club owns all the equipment. The club owns all the buggies, all the boats, everything associated with the farm. You know, the club owns.
For over 30 years, Lyle Real Estate has been connecting land investors and outdoorsmen with sellers. Whether looking to invest in an income-producing farm or recreational land, the Lyle Real Estate team has the connections and the expertise to help. They work with tracts of all sizes and specialize in agricultural, timberland, and recreational properties. New listings are hitting the market almost weekly, so head on over to their website to learn more. www.lylerealestate.com.
Yeti. From the legendary hard coolers to the new barware series, Yeti has you covered. Or check out one of my favorite new products from them, the Loadout Series Go Box. Yeti, built for the wild.
If you could go back and maybe talk about how you developed this model, because it's different than a lot of traditional places you see in Arkansas. Like, I have partners, I have, you know, three great partners in the little farm we have. But your model is a little different than maybe what people see. Why don't you explain that and maybe talk about, you know, how you find these guys, where they come from? Cause I, you know, you got some guys scattered out all over the place, that have been members there, and maybe talk about that component a little bit. Cause that's pretty interesting.
Okay. What I did was I took the, we only hunt two groups of people. We try to put seven in a group. Everything is derived around, and we use a guide at Straight Lake. The members don't spend a lot of time there. They didn't buy in to spend a lot of time there. And honestly, you know, I hope none of them are listening when I say this, but like we don't necessarily want them to be there. You know, like a lot of guys, you can't turn them. $500,000 tractor over to a guy that doesn't really know how to operate it, or, you know, and there's a lot of things, even as simple as bush hogging. I mean, there's some places on the farm, unless you really know the farm, you can get yourself in a bind on a bush hog and not have a place to turn around and have to back out 100, you know, a couple hundred yards or something, with a bush hog behind a tractor. So, And there are some of our members that, you know, I'd welcome to come, and, you know, they're construction minded people that absolutely could come and help and run a dozer, run a track hoe or whatever. But we don't expect them to do that. But the setup is each membership gets 24 days. And that's purely a mathematical equation based on and that can change too when we start talking about these shortened seasons and all that. It'll be a new mathematical equation. But on a 60-day season, they get 24 hunts on the property, and that includes their guests. So if they bring a guest, for instance, and they wanted to come and they wanted to hunt during the season, they wanted to come hunt 4 days and bring 6 people each day, they could do that. And that's different. At Greentree, I had 2 teenage boys during the time that I was in Greentree in Southeast Arkansas, and in a fabulous place, by the way. I'm not speaking ill about it. It was just how they had it set up is you had one guest. So, you know, it was an every weekend battle with my boys, like who got to go.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, you know, and you could borrow a guest, you know, and occasionally it would work out, but I wanted to set up ours like so that people could really customize how they hunted. And there's very few people at Straight Lake that don't have multiple memberships. And if you think about that, you guys know, like, what number would you put on any average duck property that you would spend? You know, say you had a place that was 500 acres, you know, in today's times, what number would you think that would cost? Average duck property, maybe some woods, maybe some agriculture. I mean, you're going to have a couple million dollars, right?
Oh, yeah.
So our memberships, they've obviously escalated in price as we've developed and moved forward. Now we're going into, you know, year 5, maybe. They've escalated in price, but they started out at $500,000. So guys come in and they bought, you know, 3 or 4 memberships. So they had, you know, 75 days, you know, 100 days, 4 memberships, got a couple $1 million invested, and they had 4 memberships. And that gets them, you know, that's for the average guy hunting, you know, 100 days with them and their guest is a lot of hunting, you know, especially if they're just a Friday, Saturday, Sunday hunter, you know. So most of our members have multiple memberships. Being the founder, I kept 11 memberships for me and my family. And I did that on purpose, kind of thinking that I have, you know, 4 boys and a son-in-law that all like to hunt, you know, that they would all have memberships at Straight Lake one day. And so that's how we do it. And that was derived at, you know, mathematically to keep the pressure off the property. And the whole property now is about 3,000 acres. Although we have a member that we're currently negotiating with, and we feel like that we're going to get another, you know, 240 acres of woods and another 1,080 acres of agriculture bought really soon. And that's going to be a really big deal for us. And at that point, we'll have pretty much everything inside the highways, and we'll be about 4,100 acres. So
they said, y'all hunt the ag fields?
Yeah, we do. We do.
Yeah.
What we do from a management perspective, if it's not a woods day, and when I say that, you know, low overcast, cloudy, no wind, stuff like that, whoever's there on that particular day, you know, we'll say, look, it's not a woods day, you know, or it's raining, whatever, bad conditions to be in the woods. We'll say, you know, and the guides, me, the manager, you know, whatever, I'll make that call, and we'll say, you know, tomorrow's not a woods day. So we'll scout the ag, and both groups we'll go to the ag. Typically, one group is in the woods, one group's anywhere else on the farm, you know, which is a lot of area. I mean, one group on the whole farm, you know, basically, you know, you got 3,000 acres with one group on it. So, but, you know, when the weather's bad, then we'll, everybody will go hunt the fields or hunt the ag, and all of it's not necessarily ag. We've got a, you know, the old Bayou cut that we call Straight Lake. You know, there's a blind in it, and then there's a what we call the New Lake. And outside the New Lake, there's a lot of stuff that's not necessarily pure rice field ag stuff that we've developed with food and water and you know, they'll hunt those places. So it's a very diverse piece of property. There's some small blocks of woods, you know, 25, 30 acre blocks of woods that are next to where a bunch of ducks use, you know, really good ag fields. And those can really be highly productive. We've got a little deer hunting, you know, set up where we can do some deer hunting there at the farm in the afternoons. We try to make sure that we've got some stuff pumped up, you know, for teal season, at least a couple different places. We impounded, there's a cemetery there nearby, and we impounded a, what we call the cemetery lake. And, it was kind of a low end field that kind of bled into a high hill. And we kind of built a big horseshoe levee around about 35 acres. And that's really been a good place, you know, for our early teal season. And that's always like that cemetery lake and the Deadening are always where we catch our Halloween ducks. They're the first places ducks will show up, and they're also the last place ducks leave, you know, so we try to maintain those as long as we can. And the cemetery lake over there is just a moist soil unit. The Deadening, we do plant some duck food in that Deadening.
I was going to ask, how many acres are in ag production?
Out of the, let's see, in woods, there's 315 and 160, so that's 510 and 240. So about 750 acres are in woods of the whole place. And then we farmed for production last year 1,000 acres of rice and 400 acres of beans. So about 1,400 acres.
Okay. You mentioned earlier the track there to your west and not having a rest area or wanting to start a rest area. What percentage do you consider or do you have as rest areas? And I think that's the goal for a lot of people. You hear people talk about that. You know, they've got 100 acres or 160 and they want to have a rest area on it. So I'm curious what your percentage is there.
Well, I don't know if you guys have noticed, and I know y'all waterfowled for a long time, just like I have, but, you know, duck behavior's changed a little bit, and I don't know what's caused this, but back in the 90s, mid-90s to mid-2000s, that range, you could go to any duck camp anywhere and look up at the sky for 15 or 20 minutes and just stand there and look, and you could see ducks trading. North, south, east, west, there were just ducks in the air. And you don't see that anymore. Like ducks migrate at night. They get up and they fly around, you know, for an hour after daylight, you know, is your peak flight time. And then, you know, right at dark, you know, they do 45 minutes to an hour worth of activity. Other than that, they're sucked to the ground, you know. And I said, like 10 years ago, I said, like, these ducks act more like snow geese every year. You know, they'll get up and they'll bounce. They'll all get up at one time and go somewhere, but you don't really see them in the air all day long. Can y'all relate to that comment?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's no doubt.
It's different now. It is different. And I don't know what changed the behavior, you know, of these ducks. But I was listening to a podcast with I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I text Kaysen all the time and tell him, you know, how much I enjoy the show and that I enjoyed, you know, a certain guest or whatever. But I was listening to one of Ramsey's guests on his podcast the other day, and there was a guy talking about biology, works with Cohen, you know, in Tennessee, and he was talking about, like, the theory of maybe there's three subsets of mallards, like you got your mallards that come, you know, your Halloween ducks, and then you got your mid-continent migrators that kind of will come to Arkansas on a really good weather year, but really hang up north. And then you've got some that don't leave the north, you know, they don't leave North Dakota. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've said several times that, like in our area where we're at in Woodruff County, that on an average weather year, maybe last year I would say was less than average weather year, but on average weather year that, like, you know, that maybe 50% of the mallards migrate either to our area or through our area. And then on a less than average weather year, you know, maybe we get 25% of the mallards to or through, you know, our area. Can y'all relate to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's this old school way of thinking that we all grew up doing, and it was, you know, big cold fronts move ducks, and that's when we're going to get them. And I subscribe to the theory that no longer is the case.
Early water.
Yeah. It's, I mean,
early water and manage your ducks.
Yeah. But it's the photo period, is when the ducks are moving, and that's what it is. And the cold fronts don't. And we saw it this past year with transmitter data. You know, I don't know if you were on that call last week with Doug, but he's posted some other stuff, Osborne, and some of his ducks, they, in the coldest of cold, it's been in a while, and the longest cold stretch we've had in a while. I mean, that hung around much longer. And a lot of those ducks never turned their beak south. They went east.
Are they moving east?
Yeah.
They migrated big water.
You know? That's right. They were
far south as they were going.
That's it. And so this, you know, this banking on a cold front's going to turn everything around. I just don't believe it works that way anymore.
No. I mean, in January, you know, early January, I'm not a proponent of hunting after the, you know, like we do it, but I'm not a fan of hunting after the 15th of January. I think it's terrible for ducks.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking those pair bonds and all that. But yeah, like early cold fronts, I always say, like, if we can get some ice in November, I said, look out, boys, you know, cause you're getting that at that point, you've already got your Halloween ducks. And if you can get ice between the 10th of November and our season opening, you know, I feel like that gets those ducks moving, you know, and they will migrate south. But that late cold stuff, when it happens in January and stuff like that, not going to work.
I think those ducks early in that cycle like that are still, they're still sampling where they're going to overwinter.
That's right.
Now there's birds that leave Canada knowing they're coming to Arkansas, or they're coming to my place or yours or Brent, you know, there are those birds. And then there's others that figure it out as they go. But once they settle in, which to me is around the solstice, you know, they're not going to budge a whole lot after the solstice. They've decided that they can make a living where they are. This idea that, you know, we need to move duck season back to February, March is insane. Back to the cold front idea, you know, for the past 40 plus years, I've heard it from my father and grandfather that, you know, it was early birds. Birds migrate early. The peak of our mass migration is early in November. And then from there, you're really just subject to some weather. But the birds move early. I believe that basically my entire life. So we've long since have been believers in early water, early habitat. You know, set the table early and you'll have them.
You know, and it's funny about those early ducks too. If you look ahead at when the full moon's going to be, you know, they're either going to come between the 15th. You know, if the full moon is in the middle of October, then ducks are going to show up mid-October. And if the full moon is at the end of October, they're going to show up, you know, Halloween. And it's weird because not this past season, but the season before, our ducks showed up October the 16th, and we were unprepared. you know, we were getting it on, but we weren't there yet, you know, like, and I mean, it was, we were scrambling, you know, to get water. I'm like, there's 100,000 ducks on the Dednan, you know, like they're going to eat it out in a week. We need to get some water on, you know. We were scrambling to get some more water on, you know. They just come early. We were preparing for Halloween and they showed up the 15th of October.
Well, and that's, so my father and grandfather always talk about what they call the midpoint, which was exactly that, the midpoint between the equinox and the winter solstice, which typically, give or take, falls around the, you know, Halloween to the first week of November. But that's where they always kind of got their barometer for how the year was going to look based on what we had at that point. And you could tell what to expect for the rest of the year based on what we saw early like that. But that brings up another question I've got for you. You mentioned the birds getting there early and then food they were consuming. In the recent survey by the AGFC, they talked about proposed season dates. And one of those proposals, I think it was option A, was an option to end the season on the last Sunday in January. And then the subsequent 4 or 5 days that would have come afterwards, they moved earlier into December. Now, we both think that a shorter early December split will actually increase habitat in the state of Arkansas. And I'll explain my theory a little bit, that there is definitely land habitat that we do not flood simply because we're going to be stuck on the sideline for 10 days there, unable to hunt it. So we flood around that split. Now, I'm a firm believer in providing habitat, and I'm pretty sure I do my fair share of that. But I feel like if we had a shorter December split, you would have private landowners like yourself flooding a little differently because of that hunting opportunity, and then would be really gaining more birds throughout the state and potentially helping public hunters later in the year because we would be getting those birds early when they are willing to migrate. I was going to get your thoughts on that since I know you have to deal with that, the subject of you've got more birds than you have food, and you have to manage that food resource too. So what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, what I see the ducks doing, and you're spot on, and we absolutely, you know, stage flood, and we're saving some stuff and not giving them everything, you know, at one time, and we're kind of putting some water on early. We're getting enough water to hunt the first split, you know, getting the woods pumped, obviously. You know, I mean, like last year that we kind of held out a block of woods and kind of brought it on later, you know. Maybe a couple of blocks of woods, now that I think about it. And then, but the ag stuff, yes, absolutely. We're flooding some stuff early enough to get through the first split. And then about halfway through the split, you know, while the season's closed, we're turning on additional water and getting that pumped up. And then by the 10th of January, you know, we're probably sometime between the 1st of January and the 10th, we're putting the water on the last of our stuff. So really, like, full flood, you know, we're finally fully flooded by the 15th of January, you know, so we have some fresh food, and then we try to leave that food after the season for the longest because we know that the other stuff has been eat out, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've become a real fan of Milo. Yeah. Same vertical cover, a lot cheaper to plant than corn. And we also do some, you know, like some dirty corn. And we don't really hunt it. It's really just down in front of the tower. We've got an observation tower down that looks over the Dednan, and then we plant one field there and kind of leave it for the ducks. And it's kind of in between two blocks of woods. And it's just a cool place to go watch them roost in the evening and a good place to scout and kind of judge, how many ducks you're holding, you know, on the farm, and kind of eye candy, you know, just kind of water.
Yeah. Well, Milo will tolerate wet feet a lot better than corn will.
Yeah, and it's you know, like I had some Milo that got in, the army worms got in it really bad and ate it to the ground. Really? I didn't notice what was going on. It didn't take them long. I mean, I'd been there a week before. And had an incredible stand of Milo, ate it to the ground. We come in and sprayed it in probably July. And that fall, we had heads and it had reproduced. So pretty resilient, you know, kind of come back and still producing seed head. And I don't know, I was impressed by that little situation that we had. I was like, you know, that's pretty impressive that it'll still make food and still hold ducks. And so we're still in our infancy. We learn stuff every year, you know, how to do things a little different. We try to pay really close attention. We try to pay, you know, like it's a culmination of little things around the farm that that turn into big things. We get out early, whether we're in the fields or the woods. You know, we're drop dead back at the lodge, you know, shortly after 9 o'clock. A lot of times in the woods, early season, we're out of there by, you know, we're out by 7:30, you know, and, but if at 8 o'clock, we've had a great hunt, you know, maybe a few birds short of the limit or whatever, we're getting out, you know, to try to preserve that. And, crazy thing, we have a meeting, members meeting in August is when we do our draw and kind of set things for the season. And then in February, it's mainly a financial meeting and a rehashing of the season, the things that we did good, things we can improve on or whatever. In the February meeting, we'd always been shooting 20 gauges in the woods. And I was, you know, the 20 gauges worked really well, but we had a little thing at Straight Lake called the Silver Mallard where you could shoot your limit four ducks, four shots with a 410. Of course, one of our members, we kind of talked about this, how we were going to do this. And we've got a really nice plaque where everybody's name gets engraved on it after you complete it. It's a pretty cool deal. So early last season, I was thinking, I was like, I need to do that. You know, I'd like being the founder, I'd like to be the first one on the plaque, you know, like 50 years from now, 100 years from now, that'll be cool, you know. And so one of our members, he pulls out his 410 and he says, I'm declaring, you know, I want to do my Silver Mallard. And I was like, oh God, he's going to do it before me. And he pulls up and he shoots the first duck, kills it with the 410. The second duck he kills with the 410. I'm like, oh God, he's 50% there. I'm in trouble. And this guy can shoot. And he's a very good shot. And the third one come in and just like everybody's watching while he's doing this because the 410 going off basically becomes the shot call, you know, and you pay attention to the duck that he's shooting at, and then everybody else can clean up, you know, what's left. And the third one come in and like give him the biggest juke and turn like right as he shot and he missed. And he was sleeving up his 410. You're like, dang, I got close. But did y'all see that guy? Did y'all see that duck do it? And I was like, yeah, I seen it. And he was sleeving his gun back up. And I said, hey, look, if you don't mind, the ducks were really falling in there good that day. And I said, hey, if you don't mind, do you mind me shooting your gun and me trying the Silver Mallard? And so I was able to get that done first. Pretty cool moment. But in the meeting, I brought up, I was like, guys, how about if we just go to 28 gauge and 410s in one block of woods, our big block of woods? I said, I think it'll make a huge difference. And I never thought our members would vote for that. I thought they were going to laugh me out of the room. And everybody voted for it unanimously. So we have one block of woods now, and it's a one-year trial. I said, look, let's just try it. You know, if it works, great. If everybody likes it, great. If you don't, then we'll go back to 20 gauges. But we have one block of woods now, the big block of woods, 410 and 28 gauge only. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, more people are going to those sub gauges, especially in the woods. You know, you shoot a decent bullet nowadays. It's just as good as, yeah, just good as anything. So, but yeah, I mean, you can appreciate that too, because it gets back to it's a offshoot of the pressure piece, because that shot going off in the woods out of those guns is a lot different than, you know, 12 gauge cranking off, yep, three.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's commendable, because yeah, you can definitely get it done. I mean, I've hunted Greenbrier before, but I've never been able to hunt their whole, where you're required to shoot a 410. They got a 410 hole in their North Woods. I've only hunted the North Woods once, and we didn't hunt that particular spot. But you're required to shoot a 410, and they were doing that before all the fancy shot shells came mm-hmm. out. So,
I think that kind of stuff in a place, you know, builds stories and legends. You know,
oh, no doubt, about it. Yeah, those traditional elements are just cool. I mean, that place is that particular hole is known for that. And you don't got to show up with a 410. They've got a whole gun case full of them. So if that's the hot hole and that's where you're going that day, you just borrow a 410 and that's what you're shooting. Mm-hmm. But it's right. It's stuff a legend.
Yeah, who cares about the numbers anyway? I mean, go hunt in a legendary place that does legendary things, you know. I always say this waterfowl, and I know y'all can probably add some words to this list, and I'm not going to catch all of them, but, you know, waterfowling to me is a diamond, you know, and a diamond has many facets, you know. There's a lot of things about the history and the tradition and the stories of our, you know, of older men that have participated in waterfowl and, you know, the decoys and the dogs and the guns and the calls and the camaraderie and the friendships and the campfires and the sunrises, the sunsets. I mean, I could put a label on every facet of a really big diamond, you know, and I don't know. It's just been a big part of my life. It's a big part of my children's life. I want it to be, you know, I told one of our members not too long ago, I was like, he's like, man, you're super passionate about this. Do you ever stop thinking about how you're going to improve this place? And I go, no. And I said, because I'm thinking about my grandchildren's grandchildren, you know, hunting here and enjoying this place. And I want these traditions, you know, passed through our family, you know, for decades to come. I'm not thinking about tomorrow. I'm thinking about 30 years from now, you know.
Right, right. Well, that's awesome. And you know, Kason obviously comes from that same lineage. I do as well, to where I'm looking way down the road at this piece of property being something, you know, long after I'm gone, that's going to be that cool, and trying to develop those traditions and this is how we do things and, you know, being able to sustain that's key, because some of that's missing a little bit in the sport. And it's up to guys like us and us to imprint that on our kid. We talk about imprinting ducks all the time. We got to imprint that on our kids. So, you know, a generational thing becomes, you know, what we learned and what we grew up doing keeps going on down the line. And I think that's huge in this sport right now.
Yeah. And if you, those youth, I mean, we have some youth hunts that were, you know, like, and I don't want to get on my soapbox about the Arkansas Game and Fish and what they do to the youth season, which is just horrendous. I will say my thoughts, though, they need to open youth season before anybody has shot at a duck. They ought to let the youth go out there and shoot a duck, and they ought to give them a weekend. A full weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody's hunting. I mean, how awesome would it be if youth season in Arkansas, and maybe there's two zones or something to that, but like, man, if you could take our kids November the 6th and 7th, youth hunting.
You're going to create hunters for life.
Yeah. I mean, making them go in February. I mean, what are you giving them in February? Ducks have been shot up and seen everything by February, you know.
Yeah. And I understand the argument about, you know, access for public hunters. And I understand all that, but I'm 100% with you. You know, if you need to make a public zone or private zone, do what you need to. But you let a kid go in early November and see all the birds that they can see and experience that, then that's recruitment of hunters. You're going to keep them.
Absolutely. And, you know, in some of our youth hunts, you know, the stuff in February that they do, you know, the youth will go out there and, you know, maybe they kill five or six ducks, you know, whereas a group of adults could have probably killed 10 or 15. But, man, those kids are as happy as a lark out there. You know, like, they get it. They haven't been corrupted to think that they have to kill a limit every time they go. they're just glad they're out there. You know, like, it's like the purest form of appreciation, you know?
Yeah. And everybody's not burned out. You know, February rolls along. I mean, the parents are worn out, burned out. Mama's ready for dad to be home and, you know, yeah. Kids be home and all that. And, you know, the energy level's at an all time high, optimism's high. All that is high at the beginning or early in the season. And it is not in February.
No,
it's just not.
I've never understood why they did that. I was just like, and like our guys, you know, y'all asked earlier, like, where are our members from? Our members are from, you know, really, I say they're from the SEC, because we got guys from Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, a couple guys from Arkansas, one guy from Texas, you know, me from Louisiana. You know, really, really the SEC. I mean, like, and it makes it fun during football season. It's camp, you know, like, Georgia fans, and Alabama fans, Tennessee fans, and Ole Miss fans, Mississippi State fans, you know, just a lot of fun. And it's created a good environment. Like, I like baseball. And one of our members, great guy from Mississippi, he's got tickets to Mississippi State. And I went over, even though LSU didn't play very well, I went over and watched Mississippi State play LSU in Starkville and, you know, spent some time with their family. And we turkey hunted a little bit. And it was a great time, you know. So it opened up some opportunities, and it's really created some great friendships. Mallard Duck has brought a lot of people, common thinking-minded people together, you know.
Oh, there's no question. No question.
Well, Max, talk a little bit. We've covered a lot of really great stuff so far, but I still want to get to this before we wrap up here today. But talk a little bit about the banding program and y'all's involvement with what Doug Osborne is doing.
Doug reached out to me. I guess he was looking for a banding site, you know, in Northeast Arkansas. And obviously that banding takes place best in the woods, you know, after the season. The way that we're trapping ducks, by, you know, traditional methods of trapping, it works best in the woods. And
right, swim-in traps for people that are listening.
What's that?
The swim-in traps is what you're talking about.
Which I think that you know, it's a great way to do it. The ducks are not in the trap very long before you're getting them out. You're not having any mortality with that, you know, style trapping and all that. And so it's working really well. But Doug and his crew do a great job. I've enjoyed meeting the biologist and working with the biologist. And we actually hired one of Doug's biologists. We have a full-time biologist that works at Straight Lake, and Jacob Bethel. He's done a really good job. He lives close to the farm. But the banding is something that's super important to me. It's kind of proved to me what I've always thought about phylopatry. We're seeing that, you know, in harvesting some of our bands that have been put on since 2019. You know, those bands trickle back in, and we're seeing those. And we have a thing at Straight Lake: if it was banded at Straight Lake and it's killed at Straight Lake, then the band goes in the lodge, and we get the person to kill the band. They can have the certificate, and we can get them a duplicate band. But the original bands, and everybody's honored that, and it's been really cool. It's kind of ceremonial now, you know, after breakfast. We'll have a little band ceremony, and he'll, you know, the person that kills it gets to band one in the lodge. So it's pretty cool. You know, those things are just good traditions, you know, that we enjoy. But this year, I think we did, this year we banded about 1,600 mallards. We've been the number one site in the state as far as numbers in the past, I guess, 5 years. Jacob and I work really hard at banding, though. We, as soon as the season's over, we're getting the bait put out. It's a ton of work. I mean, a ton of work, but it's very rewarding, you know.
Well, are you seeing, you know, between harvest and then catching them in the net? Are you seeing a lot of them? You know, what's your ratio of returning ducks or percentage? You know, what are you seeing as far, you know, you talked about the foul pattery and the sight fidelity and everything else. How many are you catching, you know, the following year, and you pull a duck out and it's got a band on it? Are you seeing a lot of those getting trapped again? Or
we are.
Or, and then harvest wise.
Yeah, we do recapture. And then harvest wise, you know, I can't really put a percentage on it. Like there's been a ton of ducks banded at Straight Lake, and we've killed, you know, in the past 3 or 4 years, we've killed 10 or 12 bands that were banded at Straight Lake. And the percentage is definitely higher, or the average is more in favor of it being banded at Straight Lake than it being banded elsewhere. You know, and I would say that's about a 3-to-1 ratio, you know, for every three that's killed, you know, three are going to be banded at Straight Lake and one is going to come from somewhere else. But, you know, there's so little pressure at Straight Lake that there's a lot of bands that are there. But there's a lot of ducks that are there that don't even know they're getting hunted. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because Ed can go out and lay on a levee and take pictures of banded mallards, you know, standing on a levee, catch them in the air. You know, a lot of his band photography, I think there was only one duck that he hadn't photographed banded, and he ended up photographing a banded pintail, you know, standing on a levee at Straight Lake. And I'm like, and we'll, believe it or not, we'll end up banding, you know, a few black ducks, a few pintails, and we band more wood ducks than we've ever seen during hunting season. I don't know where they come from, but we don't shoot. I bet we don't shoot 5 wood ducks a year, you know, and we go to banding season and we'll band 300, you know, 500 wood ducks. Wow. And this year, the anomaly was, you're going to think this is funny, but the anomaly was we ran out of teal bands. We were catching so many teal in the woods. It was crazy. And like, I was like, Doug, we need more teal bands. He goes, I don't have any more. Like, y'all have used every teal band that I have. And I'm like,
wow.
That's, you know, but like those teal were just getting in those traps. Like, I'm like, we were turning them out. Like, we'd catch 100 and just turn them out. You know, like, we don't have any bands to put on y'all. Y'all are free to go.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch here, especially, you know, with the freeze and then post-freeze. There were a bunch of teal around for mid to late January. I think a lot of people were seeing that. So that kind of correlates a little bit. Plus, you probably caught some by February. You're probably catching ones moving back north, too. So that made the kind of perfect storm. Catch a bunch of teal.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of teal. We finally just, we quit trapping in one trap because it would just fill up with teal every night.
Yeah.
And we just left it open and just abandoned it because it was just becoming a nuisance. But no, we enjoy the banding. It's kind of like youth season though. You know, you're wore out, you're tired, and you know, as soon as hunting season's over, you know, we're starting that banding up, and then we work pretty hard at it for about 10 days. And then Doug and the students come in and we usually run it for about 10 or 15 days, you know, but we transmitted, I think we did 65 transmitters on hens only. Those ducks also got bands. And the pinpoint accuracy is very accurate to that. We had one biologist called and said, one of our hens didn't make it. And do y'all know who owns this property? And she sent me a pin, and I knew who it was. And I called him and I said, look, do you mind if I go down there and recover a transmitter? Something's got this duck, you know, and there's a transmitter down here on your property. So we went down there and literally just walked right to it. Based on GPS coordinates. So it's incredibly accurate.
That and a Google Earth pin, you can walk right up on them. I saw a It's funny, I saw a post on Instagram a couple months ago. Somebody had recovered one. And of course, all the comments were, man, talk about a needle in a haystack. How'd you find that? And I commented, I was like, how close to Google Earth get you? And I think I ruffled the guy's feathers because the secret was up. I was like, man, we've recovered a number of white front transmitters like that. You just, they're out there. You go pick them up. And that's great. You get to put it back out, redeploy that unit, and save that money that that little unit costs. So.
Yeah, those things are expensive, you know. And
yep.
Our members are doing a lot, you know, in donating to those programs and stuff like that. And they've become enthralled, you know, increased their passion for these, for waterfowl, you know, being a member at Straight Lake and seeing what goes on and how we do things, you know, man, it's just been great. I mean, I'm just blessed, you know, like I'm blessed beyond what I deserve, you know.
I think it's important for listeners to realize how important, you know, these banding efforts are because Kaysen does it and you're doing it and you take a handful of places that Doug and others, he's not the only one, that do quite a bit of banding on a lot of the Five Oaks ground that George has. And I think it's important for people to realize how beneficial this is to waterfowl research and understand what these ducks are doing, because there's not a lot of banding going on, you know, in Canada anymore. And, you know, several of the banding stations have been abandoned. Some of them in the Dakotas and Montana and places, you know, the plains of even in the United States. They're just not doing a lot of spring and summer banding anymore, to where that data is going to be able to be tracked. So what we're doing here in the state with all these banding operations are extremely critical for understanding more about what ducks are doing, because we'd be running out of bands if we were counting on the traditional methods like we all grew up. You know, they were doing very few banding locally, even though the very first one I killed when I was 13 was banded in Ethel, Arkansas, which is basically in the White River Refuge. But back then they were banding very few in-state, and now we're banding way more in-state than they banned, you know, well north of us. And that's extremely critical.
I'll have to dig those numbers up, Brent, about what percentage we're banning now compared to whatever number of years ago on the federal level, not just here locally in Arkansas. But I want to say on that call with Doug the other day that reported rate on bans is only like 2.5 to 5%. It's incredibly low on band recoveries. And that's why big banding projects are really important. So you guys that are listening out of state, you need to start making your voices heard. We need more of this research going on, because it's impossible to know what's happening with our resource without this type of research.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's probably, you know, there's lots of talk about, you know, is the way that we're currently doing, you know, BPOP counts and the way that we're determining what our population of waterfowl is, you know, is there some way to use band data to back into a number, you know, and Kaysen, you may be able to expound on that more, but I mean, I think that that's a critical portion of determining what this is. And I have guys, you know, ask me all the time, you know, like, why don't ducks come to Mississippi anymore? And why don't they, you know, I said, man, I think it's habitat driven, you know? And I said, I think it's weather. I think it's habitat. And I think it's total numbers, you know, and it's a distribution thing. When there's more ducks spread out more, you know, they're utilizing more habitat. So I don't know. There's
the band data goes into Peterson estimates, which are kind of a backdoor way of estimating BPOP, much like the BPOP surveys. But Peterson estimates were for the longest time the way that it was done before the surveys. And there's some really, really eye-opening information that came out of the flyway meeting here recently from Ray Alasaskas about Arctic geese and some duck numbers based on Peterson estimates. We're going to try to get him on the show to dive into that further. But yeah, to answer your question, it does go into that, and that's how those estimates are run through harvest.
Yeah. Well, you know, the flyway council meeting this summer will be interesting. I can't wait to here. I'm not looking forward to a shortened season. If it was up to me, I would take 60 days and one duck.
Well, yeah. I don't. During season this year, I was pretty convinced we were going to land on restrictive here at some point. Knowing now about this IPM model and how they're kind of changing things, I don't know that we'll see restrictive. That's not to claim that it's intentional or not, but it sure seems odd to me that after X number of years of doing things one way, we decide now to change that up. I have some questions about that. We'd like to find, Brent and I are both trying to find a guest that can answer those questions, but the change in modeling may keep us out of restrictive, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and honestly, if they'll choose the dates properly, and I'm not saying I don't like hunting 60 days, but if I had to choose between 60 and 30, I'd take 45. if the dates were proper, if they give us the same November and right. give us about 15 days in December, give us a nice break for Christmas. I like the Christmas change of the 26th being closed, because I live in Louisiana and that was tough to leave Christmas Eve to be back to hunt on the 26th.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that we can only stop and start it twice, because I think we would all like to see some different splits. But to your point, I think you're 100% right. If we managed, the days, you could get a lot more. You could get more out of 30 days than what we're getting necessarily per day out of 60, because there's a lot of days that are wasted. Full moon, a lot of stuff's wasted after the 15th of January. You're dealing with pair bonds and all kinds of stuff, and there's just not that many quality days in that 60-day season.
I would love to see the season close January the 10th.
Yeah. I don't know. I grew up that way. So I guess in my mind, every year, not long after Christmas or after New Year, I just start thinking, man, it's time for this to be over with.
It is. I mean, you can tell the ducks are just, they're yeah. difficult. I mean, they're different. Bonded up, and it'd be best to leave them alone and go ahead and start your banding January the 10th and be done by February. And then you could really leave them alone, February to mid-March, and then kind of start pulling your water down, be like I'm a big proponent of that late water, keeping some water on the late, building those ducks back up before they go back to Canada,
Canada, it's all about body condition.
Yeah. And we see that in the banding. You can see some, occasionally you see some very poor body condition ducks, our particular, you asked me about banding earlier. I sent this to you yesterday, but we were 4 drakes to 1 hen, ratio banding. I was pleased to see as many hens as we did have, because during the season, I would have questions. Sometimes it was just like, big groups of drakes, just all drakes. I'm like, golly, where are the hens at? And we try not to shoot the hens. We don't necessarily have a rule against it, but we're definitely not going to target hens. And if I see, in the first couple of volleys, if I'm guiding the group, and we're killing some hens, I'll tell everybody, hey, just pay attention. Let's don't shoot so many hens, just be cognizant of what we're doing here,
Well, we're on that call with Doug last week, talking about that, the sex ratio. And to that point, I don't remember who it was on the call that questioned and wondered, what was happening there. What was different between, season to season, why it was shifting like that. And the answer is pretty clear. It's the habitat driven answer. With poor nesting habitat, the hens are just absolutely getting hammered on the nest ground. And we've seen it with our transmitters on hens, that mortality rate seems to be about 3 times higher than what AHM factors for. And I think with poor habitat and poor nesting conditions, we're seeing it just become worse and worse. And I think that's where Brent and I are in regards to hen harvest, that, when times are thin like this, harvest does start to matter, at least more than when you have 10 million ducks. So, the sex ratios are kind of eye opening. And I would advocate everyone, you know, practice a little self-restraint. And I know everyone's going to say, well, you can't stockpile ducks. And they're right. You can't. But every extra hen we send back to the nesting grounds is, you know, she may die from predation, but, you know, her life may spare the next one. So
that hen that I was talking about earlier that we went and picked up the transmitter on the neighbor's property south of Straight Lake, obviously hawk eagle, aerial predators, you know, and that's something that I've noticed that I really pay attention to a lot, you know, is I think we've, and I don't know if anybody tracks this or if there's a population on this, but I've noticed an increase in aerial predators. And I don't know if that's because we have a duck farm with a fair number of waterfowl, but it seems like we have an explosion in the eagle hawk population. And I've never heard or asked a biologist. I've talked to Doug about it a little. And I think it's not talked about because they don't want the hunters to be angry at the aerial predators. But an eagle and hawks can put more pressure on my ducks at Straight Lake than any boat buggy human could ever think about putting on those ducks. And there's nothing you can do about it, you know. But I'll see those eagles go in and land at an intersection of a levee, and I'm watching those ducks. I spend a lot of time in binoculars at the lodge and watching ducks and watching where they're at, what they're doing. And those ducks will get on red alert as soon as that eagle lands on a levee. And as soon as that eagle spreads his wings to take back off, that whole group of ducks will bust and go somewhere else. They'll leave that field and go to another field. I mean, they're just constantly harassed, yeah, you know, by the eagles.
Yeah, and those are situations where that vertical cover and early successional habitat is really good at giving them that protection.
Well, that's what, and I think that's what drives a lot of our ducks to the woods. I think they feel safe in the woods, and they're in the shade, and you know, obviously they're in there eating on invertebrates and bugs and stuff like that. But no, it's good stuff, man. Good stuff. Really blessed.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, man. We enjoyed having you. Enjoyed talking. We appreciate you being here.
Man, I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks to all of our listeners out there. You can find us online at thestandardsportsman.com, on social media at thestandardsportsman, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank y'all.
Light boots. The lightest pair of knee boots you're ever going to find. Weighed in at just 13 ounces each. Putting on a pair of light boots is truly a jaw-dropping experience.